Doesn't always have to be clean. That'll depend on the person too, but it's loading earlier in the week and then cleaning. You're basically filling up, it's filling, and then you're cleaning up the mess for the last couple of days. And when I say mess, basically just sub-Q water, and then you're going into the show dry and hard and full.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to Blood, Sweat, and Gear with coaches Skip Hill, Andrew Berry, and myself, Scott McNally. All of our programming is brought to you by TrueNutrition.com. Use our code THINK for additional savings. High-quality third-party tested supplements. They've got every kind of carbohydrate powder you can think of, every kind of protein powder you can think of, a lot of other supplements. Seriously, check them out because you're a bodybuilder. You use supplements. You can support our program and get really good stuff by using our code. There you go. We're also brought to you by SupplementSource.ca for Canadians. They have great deals that change week to week. And we're brought to you by Patreon. I think I got a couple Patreon questions today. And I'm doing a lot of early releases on Patreon lately. So at least a couple times a month, you'll get to see stuff early over on Patreon. Thank you guys for all your support. Guys, we're going to talk about, we're going all the way back to basics today, carb cycling. It's kind of a really, I think, a no-brainer when you're coaching 12 plus hours a day. Carb cycling is just part of the vocabulary. But let's take it all the way back and talk about it. What would be a good way to break into this, Skip? Or Andrew?
Well, I'm not Skip, but I can start.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm not Skip. But I think every single diet, whether it's a contest diet, an off-season diet, has a component of carb cycling in it.
A cyclical
unless
aspect.
You're just a rare, yeah. Unless you're just a rare person that eats the same five or six meals to a T every single day, which I don't think that's a very bright way to do it, honestly, because I think there's a lot of magic happening with cycling your calories in general in terms of your metabolism and effects on leptin and other secondary messengers. But, you know, carb cycling, I think what we're talking about mainly is in a dieting sense where you might program in some lower days, lower carbohydrate days, and then follow it with a certain number of high carb days. And how you set that up, there's no, like none of us as coaches could say, this is the carb cycle you need to plan. What right. happens is your coach starts you with something that makes sense, right? And then they read and react and monitor and make changes. So for instance, I might start somebody on a three low, one high. So let's just say, you know, a 200-pound bodybuilder, they're deep in their diet, we switch to a carb cycle, and we're doing, say, 3 200-gram days, and then on that fourth day, they're going to bump it up to 400 grams of carbs. And then we start the cycle over again. And as a coach, my job is to monitor and see, okay, A, are we losing body fat, and is the scale going down? B, are they getting flatter by that third or fourth day, eliciting the need for a higher-calorie refeed day, that high day? Or do I need to make some changes? Do I need to go to, say, 4 low days and 1 high day? Do I need to do something like 3 low days and 2 high days? Do I need to drop them all the way to like 10 low days and then just one super high, super compensation refeed day? Probably similar to like an old fashioned skip load, right? Yeah. So I think there's a million different ways you can cut it. But basically, it's exactly what it sounds like. You're cycling your carbohydrates and thus cycling your calories.
And that pretty much, I mean, we can go on to the next topic.
All right, next question.
It's actually a really good overview because I completely agree with you. If you had, you know, 20 trainers, good trainers in a room, and you had them lay out what they might start a client with for, you know, a carb cycle, you're probably going to have 20 different approaches that aren't exactly the same. Almost certainly. And one of the things that is different with my cycling or my dieting is because I skip load typically on a weekly basis with my clients and myself. So as an example, the first couple days after a skip load, those are going to be, and not all the time, but usually can be lower carb days because you're riding off of the carbs that were stored from the skip load, of course. So, and there are a couple things that I might do a little bit different than someone else in the sense that a couple things that stand out are I do like to have higher carb days or higher carb intake on non-training days when either myself or my client may be training earlier in the day the following day. Because, and Andrew, you know this because we've talked about this quite a bit, I'm not as big on carbs coming into a workout. Like a pre-workout to me or a pre-workout meal doesn't necessarily have to be, oh man, I have to make sure I have carbs in there. I rely more on the stored glycogen versus circulating blood sugar levels. So, and there are a lot of variables. So if, you know, any of my clients are listening going, well, gosh, he doesn't do that to me. There are other clients who are listening going, oh yeah, he does that with me. So there is that individual component, and there's a lot of variables that go into, as you said, Andrew, whether that's going to be, you know, 3 low, 1 high, 5 low, 1 high, a skip load that is considerably higher, and whether that skip load is clean, whether it's more, you know, poke bowl, high rice, you know, type of a load, or if it's, you know, five guys because you're depleted and you're further into. We had Nick on the last show talking about the sometimes when he loads, he'll go, or when he does high carb days, if he's not filling out from that, then he may end up with a, you know, burger and fries or something like that to help to compensate, to be able to get more calories and more carbs in too. So there's a myriad of different ways to do it. We should probably give an example. I mean, you gave some examples of, you know, 3, 4 low and then a high. But what are you doing? Are you keeping, Andrew, are you keeping the same food sources, but then just increasing on that one day? So maybe if, you know, rice may be the predominant carb, then you're just increasing those carbs with rice then on the higher carb day, right?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. So yeah, typically, like, and this is how I start out on a carb cycle. I typically do like a 3 low, 1 high, right? And literally what I will do is just do more of the same foods they're eating on that high day. So, and this is where it gets variable, because when you have a new person, right, or a less experienced athlete, you kind of have to spell it out a little bit more. And as Skip has taught me, sometimes you literally need to explain every little detail, because sometimes I just say, add in 200 grams of carbs that day. And they might say, read that as 200 extra grams of rice.
Pop-Tarts.
In that case, they've only really added. Well, so that's where I'm getting though, actually, because I do find that with more experienced athletes, or even as you get deeper into the prep,
yeah,
I might say, okay, add in a 500 gram carb day today. And they might say, well, do I need to stick with all my rice or my cream of rice? And I'll say something like, you can pick and choose the carbs you do, but just be mindful of what you think I would tell you to do. Meaning, you can't go to Five Guys and eat fries for your carbs, but if you want to incorporate, yeah, you want to incorporate some English muffins or rice cakes or a little bit of fruit or some jelly on the rice cakes or some of these other foods that you haven't had that are still, you know, within the confines of just carbohydrates. Right. But I feel like it gives the athlete a little bit of freedom and a little bit of mental relief in picking some of their own foods. Now, keep in mind, there are some people, though, that are like, nope, I want you to write out exactly what you want me to eat, and I will do that to a T. But I do find that about 75-80% of athletes, they do enjoy, and I feel like they get a mental boost just with that little decision-making of what carbs they're adding in. Even if they're sticking to extra rice or cream of rice, they're getting to pick where they want to put them. And I think that's an important component as you get into the prep, because where I might want to put my carbs when I'm having a higher carb day might be very different than when someone else's appetite tells them what they want their carbs. So I do think adding a little bit of that variability, letting the athlete choose, is helpful, almost in the same sense that a free meal gives. You know, it's a morale boost. Yeah, exactly. And okay, you know, so I had some fat-free waffles, or I had some, you know, English muffins, or I had some toast instead of just all rice. Just that little bit of mental boost might give them everything they need mentally, energy-wise, to get through the next hard week of dieting.
I've got an idea I'd like to throw out there. And this is, let's say this is an example for somebody that I might work with who's, let's say they're a Gen Pop person. And I'm sure you guys run into this too. I've worked with a lot of guys who weren't following a fixed plan, and they come to you and they're like, hey, listen, I want to buckle down. I want to start following a diet. I want to get in good shape. And a lot of times they can eat a good amount of food to start out, right? Like if we just put them, you can take a guy that hasn't been following a fixed diet, you put him on a clean plan, right? He's got plenty of carbs, plenty of proteins, got some fats in there, and he's going to start making progress out the gate. And what an example of what I might do for carb cycling is, let's say he's whatever, 218 to start, and we put him on this fixed plan, and just through cleaning the diet up, the next week he's like, we'll say he dropped 7 pounds or something. We'll say he was 218, now he's, you know, 211. And we're like, holy crap, man, you dropped a lot of water. And he says, yeah, well, I was only eating fast food before this. And in all of our minds, we're probably thinking, okay, we could probably ride this out for a little while. You know what I mean? And there's no targeting date. We just want to get in better shape. we could probably do this for a little while, and I'll keep riding that without doing a carb cycle for a period of time. And mm-hmm. and I might go one of two ways. If he starts to get to a point, let's say we get 6 weeks in and he's still losing fat, I might say to him, like, hey, listen, do you want to, we might address it maybe a month in. Hey, how do you feel? Do you want a cheat meal? Because we're not on a time frame. We could probably add a cheat meal in. Let's say he doesn't want to, though, and we keep riding that out, and eventually it stops. At that point, if he's feeling good, he's like, yeah, I'm not super hungry still, and but the weight isn't moving anymore. A way that I might carb cycle is taking that normal day and turning that into my high day. And now I might just reduce the carbs a little bit and turn that into my low day. So let's just say he was eating a cup of rice with every meal. Maybe we're going to go to like even maybe it's even like 3/4 of a cup of rice with every meal, or maybe we remove a cup of rice from the last two meals and we say, okay, here's your low day. Let's follow this for 2 days and then go back, or 3 days, and then go back to that high day, you know, back to your normal day. Like, boom, now we've got a carb cycle, you know, mm-hmm. And maybe he's making progress like that for a while. And then that slows. And then we say, okay, well, let's go to 3 low days and then back to your normal day, you know, and eventually you get to that point where it starts evolving, you know, and you might start needing more than just the normal day. Now we're like, okay, let's add more carbs than, you know, for that high day. I'm just trying to give an example of what that might look like for an average person that's just off the streets, never followed a diet plan. I don't, let me ask you guys this. Do you start somebody out on a carb cycle if they weren't on any kind of a fixed diet and they come to you? Are you like, out the gate, we're doing a carb cycle? Or what do you generally just try? Like, personally, I try to get a gauge on like what their baseline is going to be. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'd probably start out on a training, non-training day plan and go right from there.
Right. That'd be another and way. I might leave it.
That would be a cycle.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that's another way of saying a cycle. Yeah.
Yeah. I might even leave it though. Like if in the case of this guy, I might even say, let's just leap. That'd be another example. Let's say he trains 5 days. I might say, okay, yeah, eat that same food even on your non-training days. Mm-hmm. And let's say he's still lost 8 pounds or 9 pounds that first week. I'm like, well, we didn't need to pull anything out. We're kind of saving those cards to play, you know, save the good cards for later. And then what he does need to change, then maybe the next step could be that cycle of saying, hey, mm-hmm. on your non-training days, let's reduce the carbs. And now, boom, it's, you know, a cycle all of a sudden.
Yeah.
I might even go a different direction.
If
someone lost like 7 or 8 pounds in that first week,
yeah,
I would take that as, okay, we probably cleaned out a crap ton of fats out of their diet, especially if they're eating a lot of fast food.
Yeah, 7-8 pounds is pretty extreme. I don't know why, but yeah.
Okay, but in that example, what I would actually start doing is trying to go the other way with food and
start building it up.
Yeah, I would take that as an opportunity to install like maybe one high day, like, you know, either on, let's just say for, you know, crabs and giggles, you know, on a leg day. All right. We're gonna add an extra 75 grams of carbs on this day or something to that effect and see if we still get the same response. Cause I would love, we all would love to keep building the diet up versus pulling away.
Yeah.
Still getting a weight and the fat loss response. That's the ideal situation, is when you can add little micro changes of food and they're still dropping. It means their body is just saying, hey, we know we don't need to hold on to this fat anymore. Let's just liberate it and use it as energy. That's an ideal situation for me.
Yeah, real world, I think if somebody was, I use that big number, 7-8 pounds, I might actually, if it's four, then I would probably do exactly what I had said. I probably wouldn't build it up. But if they were able to lose a great deal, then what I would probably do is even say, hey, we could probably plan a cheat meal in sooner. Just the way I like to work with somebody who is a non-competitor is to say, like, hey, if we can give you a break once a week, then I would rather do that for that, the longevity factor, you know what I mean? Of like, let's do something that you can stick with. You can still have that Saturday night with your wife or whatever, you know? And if we could work that in as being part of the cycle, like, let's keep it the same. I don't want you to eat pizza one night and a burger the next, but we try to pick something that's going to be pretty similar. And then that's going to be every Saturday or whatever we have that load, you know? Mm-hmm.
And I don't think 7 to 8 pounds in a week for someone who just came off a fast food diet is really all that dramatic, considering the amount of sodium too, because typically when someone starts a new diet, you know, especially if they've been eating like crap, they're also taking in a lot more water and a lot more fluids like they're supposed to versus, you know, when you're eating fast food, you don't really care what your fluid intake is. So the water retention and holding water with that higher sodium from fast food. I mean, for those who don't know, and I would assume that everybody does, but fast food or food prepared in most restaurants is going to be pretty high in sodium. They want you to come back and buy their food and visit their restaurant and even a chicken breast. If you go to a restaurant and you eat a chicken breast, you go, this is the best chicken breast I ever eat. I don't know why I can't make chicken taste like this, because you didn't put extra shit in it, because they want you to come back and they're going to put those things in there, or they're going to cook it sous vide, which is the way to go.
If you what want, is that? You,
sous vide?
Yeah.
Oh, sous vide is look, if you're going to make chicken every meal, you buy a sous vide for $300-$400. What you do is you sous vide basically is, and someone may correct me on this, but I have the basics down. Okay. It's essentially sealing the chicken breast or the meat, which a lot of restaurants do, even high end, you know, even steaks, things like that. They'll sous vide, they'll put them in a bag, they'll put them in water so that, you know, obviously there's no water getting to the meat, and they cook it to a specific temperature, and then they move it to the grill, and then they cook it or they char it, and then they serve it. That will make the best chicken breast. Now, when I say the best, maybe not the best, but it'll make it juicy and it'll be consistent every single time.
Yeah.
It might not taste, it'll still taste like chicken. It'll just be like really moist, you know, good chicken.
Yeah, but the water content is big with the flavor.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I don't know how many times my chicken ends up. That's why you have to do it pretty much every meal, because if you cook it sous vide and then you reheat it 3 days later, well, it's still going to taste like crappy chicken. But if you have the time to be able, people, that's why I always laughed and said when people were doing the, what was it, the air fryer or the Ninja or something, like, you might as well just buy a sous vide and spend the extra money and make it taste really good, because the air fryer will dry out your chicken just as fast or just as much. But it doesn't, and they're always so small. The portion you can cook.
Oh, yeah.
Probably isn't all that big. But anyway, I don't know where I was going with that. I was on the fast food, and then I got to the sous vide. But anyway, that's the way to go. I think Did you guys
ever use the, what the hell was it called? Dante got it on, got me into it like years, like 20 years ago. It was like you took the chicken breast and you put it in parchment paper and put it in this toaster oven. And these two things came and like heated the sides.
No. And like a panini? Panini?
Yeah, panini.
No. Like you put it in like a toast. You
didn't George Foreman like grill.
George Foreman grill.
No. Bodybuilding 101.
You had to put it in the parchment paper, and it like kept the juices in. And I remember because I was dirt poor and I was living in someone's home gym at the time, and I didn't have anything. I had a microwave and I had a small little tiny fridge, and I was living off deli turkey and deli roast beef for most of my meals and oatmeal, right? Not even cooking it, just cold. All right. And it was some of the best progress I ever made. When you boil things down to simplicity and that's all you have, it's almost easier. But I was working with him then. He got me to get this thing. I can't remember. I don't even think Amazon was around then. So I must have went to Walmart and got it.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It cooked it. It made it juicy chicken, but man, it just took forever to cook it. So when you wanted to cook six times a day, it was such a pain in the butt. So
I don't know what that was.
I just thought of. I'll look it up. I'll see if they still sell it. But right now, I'm blessed. I have Rachel cooking my chicken all day. She cooks.
Victoria's been making ours.
Does she? Yeah.
Yeah.
She cooks all my meals, my beef, my chicken. She gets my, sushi grade tuna that I eat like two meals a day. Yeah. But you know, here's the thing. She's getting busier with her coaching.
Uh-oh.
And I feel like I'm going to have to start cooking my own meals soon. It's going to suck.
You're going to forget. You're going to forget how.
Mm-hmm.
So is there anything else, Skip, we should, I mean, I know this is just like a surface level, hey, this is how you start a carb cycle.
I got a question for Skip. I got some questions. So
yeah.
Like Skip, when you get somebody and you want to start them on like a skip load, you get a new guy, he's a bodybuilder, he's experienced, he's eating, you know, 4 to 5,000 calories a day, but he's like, Hey Skip, I want you to prep me for this show. We're 24 weeks out. You know, how do you start him out? Do you do like a training day, non-training day? Do you do like a base diet and you immediately go right into the skip loads that first week, or give me some insight on that?
Yeah, no, it's not usually skip loading right away. Now, back in the day, it usually was. And I had 95% of people respond well to it. And oddly enough, even guys who were carrying a lot of body fat, that one guy comes to mind, and I know he won't mind me using his name, but Kenneth Banks would always come to me 80, 90, one time closer to 100 pounds over his weight. Whoa. And we would skip load him right from the first week, and that guy would lose just an absurd. It was one of my better transformations over the years, and we probably prepped, I'm thinking, 4 or 5 times, and every time we would just pull, and it got to the point where it was like, bro, like, are you just going to continue to come to me, like, to challenge me, like, next time it's going to be 120 pounds or something? But it was crazy. But I found over the years that it's still better to get them, let's put it this way, it's not necessarily that it wouldn't work, but it wasn't necessary.
Gotcha.
You might as well run it 3 to 4 weeks. I mean, I just started my cut phase. I went 5 weeks before I did. And the only other thing that I've changed is I do tend to start the loads, especially if we're on a time frame, like if it's a prep or something, a little bit cleaner, and then break into heavier foods as we get in, you know, where the signs are saying, yes, we need more calories. Now, one thing I won't typically do is I won't have high carbs. Sometimes I do, but not very often. I won't have high carb days on top of a skip load, because the skip load is almost always weekly. So as an example, if I've got a client loading on a Sunday, it's not likely that I'm going to push up calories on a Wednesday or a Thursday. There are times, I mean, every situation is individual, but it's not terribly common. Usually we're running and I get the calories established during the week and tweet. It's still a cycle because there may be training versus non-training, you know, things like that. But even for a leg day, unless the leg day is late in the week, an example would be if they were going to train legs on a Thursday or a Friday and they're deep into a prep, we may push up. But then you have other variables like whether they're going to be intracarbs, whether there's insulin being used, things like that. So as an example, I may load on Sundays, but I train legs on Friday. Sometimes I still will push up another 50, 75 grams of carbs on a Friday, but there may or may not be insulin in there or reasons that I don't want to risk, you know, being hypo. So I will increase those. I remember I was training arms on Fridays, legs on Thursdays in a cut, and I would not go hypo on legs. But if I didn't come straight home after training arms on Friday, if I stopped at the grocery store, I'd be sweating before I got home. I'd start to go hypo, and that, you know, that I want to say it's a close call, but you start to get the sweats and you're like, you know, get out of my way. I need to get my food, sort of thing.
So
it's usually 3 weeks. It's usually three, four weeks. I want depletion. I want a use for that higher, because it's not even a higher car. I mean, it's a skip load. It's a substantial, you know, there's far more compensation going on with the skip load than there is on a high day. But I'm not against high days. I mean, I do that with some clients too. I know people who listen don't, it's so individual. It's so individual. They like those black and white answers. But this is a situation where you just really can't do that. We're given answers, I think, and we're talking about this topic based on what we do the large majority of the time.
Yeah. Well, even that skip load for the one person is going to probably change, you know what I mean? No, through the diet. Mm-hmm. And I think the overarching thing with the a carb cycle is that, and the way I try to explain it to people that aren't familiar with it when we do it is we're depleting you down, then loading you up. It's a process of, and the way I see dieting really is it's a series of depleting and loading,
absolutely.
You know, and it gives you an opportunity to see how somebody's going to look. One thing I'm not even sure about, Skip, and we probably talked about 100 times before, when you skip load, do you skip load into the show? Is that what you use then as the load?
Not always. Okay. It can be. There's a lot of variables. There's variables. Here's the biggest one. Do you have to make weight on a Friday night?
And
how big are you and how depleted are you? Because if you're a big boy and you're making weight on a Friday night and you have to compete Saturday morning and you're really depleted, I mean, it's a lot easier to fill out a middleweight in that time frame if they're not ridiculously depleted. versus, you know, a heavyweight who is really, really depleted. Then it comes into, well, there's basically, I was just talking about this with one of my clients just about a week ago. There's three main ways I use to load. And I won't get into them too much because that's not the topic, but I do want to put this out there. Fill and spill, which we all know because, you know, even John used fill and spill method. I've used that forever. That goes back to the longevity video. And that is, doesn't always have to be clean. That'll depend on the person too, but it's loading earlier in the week and then cleaning. You're basically filling up, it's filling, and then you're cleaning up the mess for the last couple of days. And when I say mess, basically just sub-Q water, and then you're going into the show dry and hard and full. But to do that, if you're at the top end of a weight class, good luck with that because you don't want to have to factor in the weight at that point. You're going strictly on condition and what basically is going to be your best look despite what you weigh. So if you're close to the cutoff, that's not going to work. Then comes number two, which is making the weight and potentially even drying out to get under the weight and then loading. And when you load on a Friday night into Saturday, you also have to be very, very careful to make that process efficient. You got to have enough water in there because if you're already dry, you can eat a ton of food, but digestion is going to move real, real slow when you're not fully hydrated and you're not going to be storing glycogen at a very efficient or optimal rate without enough fluid too. And then the third one is one that I use for junior USAs, which I can't get into right now, but it is radical and it worked. And if I could have gone on stage almost 19 pounds heavier when I took those pictures, I would do it. I have not replicated that since 09 and it's in the back of my brain if I ever get on stage again, but a huge, huge gamble because you either nail it and you're just riding, you know, you're on cloud nine, or you fail miserably because you were off by, you know, 10 hours and you look great on Sunday or you look great on Friday.
Let me ask you guys both a question. With your refeeds, do you have athletes or clients increase their sodium intake purposely?
Always.
Yep.
Sodium is just a horrible idea personally. I just don't think it, they're hand in hand.
I'm not saying cut it. But I'm saying, you know, just using simple, not math, but simple chemistry, knowing that to make glycogen, you need to have extra sodium, potassium, ATPase, all that. So it would behoove you not to make sure you're adding a little extra salt, at least
absolutely
like equal to the amount of the carbs that you're adding in. Like if you're, mm-hmm. I know it's impossible to figure out the numbers, but if you're a 2000 milligram sodium per day person on your base diet, and then suddenly you're doubling your carbohydrate intake, well, guess what? You're going to have a hard time synthesizing glycogen if your sodium levels aren't up to par. Yep. Same thing with the water, because you mentioned the water. That's another key thing. People think, oh, I'm going to carb up and still stay dry. Well, you can still look dry, but you still need to add water in there to get the glycogen going into the muscle, to get the carbs going into the muscle to make glycogen.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's a lot of what we were seeing, you know, back in the early days on the message boards when people would look so crazy on Sundays. Everybody's like, oh, it's carbs, it's carbs. A lot of those guys had plenty of carbs. They just didn't have enough water and they didn't have enough sodium. So then it hit the next day and they're like, oh man, I look at this picture in the elevator because elevator lighting was always so good. Elevator lighting, boutique lighting, like high end shoes. You go to the Jimmy Choo store. Great lighting. Oh my God. You want to take pictures there. And bathroom hotel, not let's put the high end hotel bathroom lighting, not Super 8 or anything like that, but high-end hotel bathroom lighting. Those three places will get you the best lighting.
Skip's back on the shoes again.
Always on the shoes.
How's my sound? We're getting a listener saying that my mic is real low.
No, I think it's a little bit lower, but I haven't noticed it.
Okay. I might have rearranged it between our episodes. Maybe I'll turn it in like that or something. This isn't the normal mic that I work on. I can see it's probably a little bit low. I'll fix that post-production if it's an issue. Thank you very much, Matt Sharp. I got another one for you guys. How about this? We got a question Andrew mentioned. We should poll this one. We had, I'm going to grab this screenshot. This is from the group. Which grip for lat width? Nags answered this question and he said yes. That was his answer.
I like the answer though. Crafty, crafty.
Yeah. I don't know. Probably go with the right side on the neutral narrow and the left side on
you're
the
wide. You're going to pull up like this?
Yeah. But then just do the next set opposite of that.
Yeah.
Well, I think this question comes because back in the day, bodybuilding folklore, that if you wanted to get a wide back, you needed to use a wide grip.
You sure
if
did.
If you wanted to add more detail to your inner back, you needed to go with that close grip.
Yeah.
And I can't remember who, if it was Dr. Well, whatever. One of the science doctors that's into bodybuilding posted studies years ago saying, look, the grip width doesn't matter. I mean, as long as you're not doing this ultra wide grip and you're not doing this two fingers touching each other grip, somewhere in between, the activation of the lat tissue is almost exactly the same. So whichever grip you feel more comfortable with, I think you got to look at your wrist and your elbow health, because sometimes people doing certain grips, it aggravates the wrist. Like, I don't know about you guys, but when you used to have to do the old fashioned chin-ups, those would kill my inner elbows.
Oh,
so I just don't do those. Yeah. You know, like the, you know, I don't know if you guys can see me. Yeah.
Yeah.
I personally prefer a shoulder width neutral grip. I just feel that connection the best. It's what I've always gone with when I do lat pull downs. That's not to say that I don't do some slightly wider grip pull downs if the people I'm training with want to do them that way. But I just think that you go with whatever grip feels the most comfortable for you. It's not going to affect your width if you go super wide or super narrow. Just go with what works for you.
Yeah. Now, there was one trainer, I won't mention his name, who was very particular about the grips. In fact, putting a red circle with a line through it saying that anything narrow, you do a rep. This is just absolutely ridiculous. Because, you know, we live in an age now, especially on social media, where you're stupid for doing things that, you know, a trainer doesn't believe you should do. So, again, I don't want to mention any names. I could say, be a jerk and say, you know, but his name rhymes with. But I won't even do that because I don't want to give him any attention. I agree with you, Andrew. I don't think there's a grip that is necessarily bad. I will say this. What the trainer was trying to say, but his rodomontading gets in the way of his ability to explain essentially the nuances of, he doesn't get into the details of why. It just, matter of fact, this is stupid and don't do this. It's a range of motion issue. So yes, the back is still working with all these different grips, but the reason I think, I'm just giving my opinion. Well, it's a weird thing to just give an opinion and not say whether something is stupid or right or wrong, but I'll try it. The old school Arnold, you know, where the wider your grip, the wider the back. The reason, in my opinion, that is not good or not great information is because it reduces the range of motion. If you have a really wide back and a wide clavicle, then a wider grip for that person might be more beneficial than someone who has narrow clavicles and a narrow back like myself and does not have the scapula coming out with this huge range of motion. I always tell my clients that if you're just outside of shoulder width, that's typically going to be where your elbows are going to, because this is an elbow game. When it yep. comes to back, the more the elbows, their range of motion, just judge where the movement of the elbows from full stretch to contraction, retraction, protraction, all that. So if you're just outside of the shoulder grip, you're going to get the best range of motion. Does that necessarily mean that that's better than going slightly wider with even like a mag grip? No, it's a different stimulus. It's slightly different. Real narrow. If you have, for someone who has narrow clavicles and a poor range of motion for the scapula, then going in closer and keeping the elbows in front. I'm going to do this here. There we go.
Yes.
The elbows in for someone who's narrow like will help the scapula to come out and forward much more so than if I was wider. So that is beneficial for me. As an example, say a pullover. That's a really good movement for
yes.
me because I'm narrow. Narrow or more narrow lat pulls to the front are a pretty good movement for me versus a wide grip because I get a better range of motion that way. And the more movement you get through the scapula, typically the more or the harder those muscles are working around, essentially underneath your armpit or around the scapula. So it still comes back to, and this is why I like what Mike said when he said yes, his answer was yes. Use a variety of grips. I'll go on record and say my favorite grip, but good luck finding it for chins, is, and I don't think it was on that, which Hammer Strength typically covers almost all their grips or all those grips for variety. But I like just outside of shoulder width or just at shoulder width or just outside. But it's that one in the middle might be it, but I can't tell because it's 2D. Obviously, I'm not standing underneath it.
Yeah.
This, see the lat.
Oh, okay, put that up again, will you? Yeah.
Inside. Okay. The inside grips, there it is. The inside grips that come out and they like neutral, right in the middle, it's kind of neutral, but then they flare out.
Yeah.
If those were straight across, I would use those as an undergrip.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Does that make any sense?
I like the look of that. I could see that. I could see
a mag
doing that.
Bar. They do have a mag bar. It's not very common, but that is an under, because you know you can turn those, you can turn most of them around. If you look at them close, they're subtle. One will be slightly under, and then you just twist the bar around and it's slightly over. I like an undergrip, but that's an individual thing for me because I'm narrow clavicle and I don't have a lot of range of motion through my scapula. I always get on my wife because when she does lap pulls, her scapula come out and they round out, and I'm like, oh. I've been training for 40 years. I want it so bad. I could have such a better back if I could get my scapula to open like that. But they just genetically, they will not open. It's like they're, I don't know, like there's fibrous cartilage in there that just will not let them come out. So that grip for me is a pretty damn good grip. But then you get into the hammer strength that has the same, you know, the lap hole that's out and up and above that's under grip. Can't use it. It does not work for me at all. So there's the individual component. You have to play with that. Nick said in the segment we were talking about with training, and I think it's a great, great point. You have to find those exercises where you feel that you're able to activate the muscle the best that you can. And that is a very, very individual thing. That's why as a trainer, I find it difficult sometimes to say, no, you must do this exercise. You must do this exercise. That's not always the case. Provided that your mechanics are sound, and you're actually doing the movements mechanically. You've got the seat. If you're using a machine, you've got the seat set correctly. You know, the bars coming in or the hands coming in, allowing for the best range of motion. Not everyone is going to feel those exercises the same. And if you're not able to feel them, if you're not able to activate those target muscles fully, then that exercise isn't going to be that good for you at all.
Yeah. I've shared my idea so many times on the pull down now. I'll just say, Skip, I like what you said with keeping those elbows in. That's what I found worked good for me. And if I get too wide, then I just start, I'm going to scoot over so you can see me. I just start going like this. I'm pulling down like this, and I'm just hitting the teres. I'm not getting into that lat at all. I found, and it was training from home, letting my ego go. I thought about the way the pullover worked, and I thought if my elbows were to track the way a pullover tracks, I'm coming down like this, and that works for me. So I'm going to hold it either shoulder width and come down like this, or I'm going to go to that close grip, and lo and behold, close grip, pull, and I pull low, man. Close grip, I'll pull down to here, like I'm talking like to the solar plexus, basically. And with that, I was able to, you know, I was able to grow my back big, thick, and wide. You know, contrary to what Arnold told me, you got to go wide to get a wide back.
And a cue, just for anybody listening, if this is not like resonating or you're not fully understanding what we're talking about, no matter the grip, if you're doing a lat, well, it goes with a row too, to be honest, but it's a little bit harder. At least with any lat pull, think of trying to touch your elbows together.
Oh, okay.
Even if you're on a chin and it's an overhand grip. Take, I wish I could, let me see, it's this, it's turning, it's that subtle elbow.
Yeah, in. there's in. I agree
Sam
with you.
Sam Brown from Elite FTS made a video about this a couple years ago, and I hit him up immediately. It was like, that is the best cue, and he was, I actually did it too on one of my Instagram, where I would do it, and I was very dramatic about it at the top. It was like a warm-up set, and I would hang or in the stretch position and then
me quick, too.
Snap both elbows in.
Yep. I'm up like that.
Show the video. Or
it's
the,
like
the
a
visual.
Exactly. It's like that. I do the exact same thing, man. Yep. Dave Crossley had a good cue that he uses. He said for him, he wanted to make sure that his elbow was under his hand.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And that's another one. Yep. Because if you watch, if you have your clients do videos, you want to see lat pulls from the side. So that you can see how the elbow and the wrist are tracking. Because remember, we all pull from our hands because our hands are attached to the bar. But that's really the only – the wrist shouldn't be taken into consideration, the wrist placement. It should be the elbow position. It's always elbow position. It's elbow position on damn near everything you do with your upper body.
So we got a couple other – so I don't know what the deal was, but last episode, it'll be two episodes from the time you guys saw this – I don't know why the comments were shut off. It was some sort of glitch with YouTube because I went back and I shouldn't have to turn them on. When I upload, they're automatically on. And then I had to go back in and manually turn them on. and then they shut off again. We only got a handful of comments. Unfortunately, it hurt the viewership of that episode. So I'm going to do my best, but you know, we only had it that one time. I blame Skip. They saw his name was on the show.
Exactly.
And so we didn't get a lot of questions. That said, we need all your guys' questions. Like, whatever you got, throw them on us and we'll tackle them. I've got one that was left on Patreon, and I already asked Ron and Dusty, and I shared one of my stories. I'll fill a little bit while I bring this up so you guys can think. Ron and Dusty and I, we already tackled this one, but we got a new group here. I want to hear what you two have to say. The question was, has anyone ever said something to you during your bodybuilding career that lived rent-free in your brain for way too long, like a judge, a coach, or a training partner? I shared a couple, including my first contest. A guy told me, it's just bodybuilding. I had made a post saying, oh my God, I was so excited. I did my first show. I can't believe I placed second place. That was so close to winning my class. And the guy who won the overall DM'd me and he was like, you didn't even come close to winning. That guy who beat you, he smoked you. You weren't even remotely. And like, I wasn't saying like, oh, I should have beat him. I was just saying, holy crap, I beat like six guys. Yeah. I'm blown away, you know? And then it turned out.
More about the other guy.
Yeah, well, when the scorecard came out, as the rest of the audience knows, if they heard It's Just Bodybuilding, I lost that show by 1 point. So there's that.
Oh, nice.
But
that's a nice silver lining for sure.
So I tried to give you guys a little bit of a fill here to think of something.
Oh, I've got one. Mine.
Oh, I didn't need to fill you, huh?
It's a long time ago, but I don't want to. I've been talking about back for quite a while. Andrew, run it.
Andrew. What did Skip say about you that you haven't forgotten?
he did tell me to sit down and shut the fuck up when I asked to be on the.
Oh! That's right. Wait,
I didn't say it like that, but.
Those weren't the exact words, but after seeing some of your other posts to people,
yeah,
I think that was the delivery. I mean, to be fair, though, I mean, I was, 19, maybe 20 years old, and I thought I knew everything. Well, I didn't act like it, though, but internally, I thought I was smarter than all these other guys. You know, like I knew I was an awesome prep coach, and I knew what I was doing. I did a bodybuilding show. Didn't you guys know that? I won my class, you know?
Right.
No, but like, I would probably say it was on actually Get Big, and I told you guys this before, but you know, I posted some of my first pictures ever, and it was weird to post pictures back then, right? Like it was a rare thing. And, I had like a pretty good off season after my first contest, and I had posted my progress pics. And I just remember the first comment was like, wow, you look good. You getting ready for that 100-meter, freestyle swim or what?
Oh,
and then the other guys like piled it on too. Like, he looks more like a backstroke guy, you know, it kind of, so I didn't post on that site any longer for a good number of years, but, that's one of them. The other one is, you know, every year it was, and these were good people that would say this, like, man, like his structure is just so good. If he could just put on 5 more pounds, well, guess what? The next year I showed up with 6 more pounds. And then the comments were, man, his structure is just so good.
Oh. You
just put on 10 more pounds of muscle and be a good pro. And it just kept on going from there to when like, I was like 240 one year. And it was like, man, if he could just put on 15 more pounds.
He'd be awesome. Oh,
man. It didn't really like, it didn't. So I
should hey, it
say
stuck that, with I've you. Been, it stuck. You it took stuck it to heart. Me, yeah.
But I'm also very realistic about genetics in this sport. And I have a great structure. But like the ability to put on muscle, like, oh, if you just start eating and training hard, you know, it's like, guys, I've been doing this since I was 14, eating and training hard. You know what I mean? So I always had a very realistic view of how far I could go. And maybe it held me back some because, you know, I feel like all of us were kind of dreamers in a sense about how far we can go with this thing. I was never one of those guys that was like, oh, I'm like Nick said in the last episode, at 17, he knew he was going to make it to the Olympia and he was going to be Mr. Olympia someday. For me, it was like, I just want to get as big as jacked as my genetics will take me. And I had a very firm understanding of science and very firm understanding of pharmacokinetics and a little bit about pharmacology at that point. So I just knew that all the things that go into bodybuilding, it's more than just desire and work. It's more than just, you know, work ethic. There's a lot of factors that have to come into play. So it didn't necessarily bring me down in such a negative way, but it was a little bit of a nudge, I guess you could say.
Sure. And when Nick said that about, you know, knowing he was going to be Mr. Olympia at 17, I knew I was going to be Mr. Olympia at 15. I'm not trying to beat him by saying, you know, I was 15. But the difference is it took me about another 6 years before I realized, I don't think this is going to happen. Like, this is not, things are not going to plan here. So by saying that, what I really mean is, I don't doubt that he knew or thought he was going to be Mr. Olympia. I don't doubt that, because I was in that position when I was younger too. It's just that there are thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of kids who feel the same way before they realize mm-hmm. what they're, it's kind of like the NFL or baseball, you know, MLB too. We have a lot of times we're disillusioned into what we like. We understand what we want, but we don't understand what it takes to actually get there. And I was fortunate enough to realize early on that it wasn't going to happen, instead of holding on to something that was, like you say, Andrew, unrealistic. I understood the genetic component of it. I understood that, you know, I mean, I remember when I said I was 15, it was 16 or 17 when I realized, oh, I got to mm-hmm. take a lot of drugs. Okay, well, I'm already in 3 years. I'm already invested, so I might as well, you know, that sort of thing, which I laugh about now. But no, the situation that happened for me was very, very clear, and it was the one thing. So I've written two articles about it on Elite FTS. His name was Steve Jones, and he was a pretty good bodybuilder in the Illinois area, but we lived in Michigan, of course, at the time. I grew up in Battle Creek, so Scott and I kind of come from the same area, about 2 hours apart. And I was working out at the Y Center, and I was in probably a wife beater or something when I was 14 or 15 years old. And I was just in there training. I didn't think I was huge or anything like that. I was just in there just training. I just was training hard and doing what I thought was right and reading the magazines and everything else. And, you know, I had what I thought was a pretty good pump going on. And I went over to the water fountain to get a drink, and this fucking huge jack dude, Steve Jones, was standing there, and he was standing there with this just clown dude who had those 1980s sweats. I could see it like it was yesterday. And he has a little bit of a gut. He's super tall. He's like, you know, 6'4", 6'5". This guy ended up going on to be a borderline professional wrestler.
Okay.
The reason I say borderline is because I went to school with Rob Van Dam, Rob Zukowski, and Dang Nguyen, and they both went, obviously everybody knows Rob Van Dam, and they were both saying when they were teenagers, we're going to be professional wrestlers, and we're like, oh, sure you are, okay, whatever, but we all trained at the same gym and everything else, and sure as shit, you know, Rob ended up being a pretty big guy in the wrestling world. Anyway, these two are standing there, Steve Jones, this jack dude, he's only like 5'6", 5'7", and walk over to the fountain, and he says, he goes, and he usually fucked with me, but this time he was serious, he goes, looking pretty big today, Ken, because, you know, back then everybody called me Ken because, you know, that's my name. And I looked at him and I was like, really? You think so? And I looked down and he just busted out laughing. He goes, no. No. And the other guy's like, oh. You know, the big goofy guy, because at least here's the thing. As much as it bothered me, it was a jack dude, you know, so I was like, you know, I cared what he thought. But the goofy ass guy standing next to him, I hated the guy with a passion anyway, because he was always just a dick to me in the gym. I was always in his way, you know, shit like that. So, and I just remember looking at him, looking at the tall guy going, you know, because I thought, if I'm going to get my ass kicked, I mean, what the hell? You just totally embarrassed me and humiliated me, you know, even though there's no one else standing there but me and these two other guys. So I ended up walking away feeling like a, you know, a schmuck. So I went and I did drugs for 30 years and I got as big as I could. Fuck that guy. it always stuck with me. And it's something from my teenage years that has always been, you know, in the, like you say, living rent free. It's always been in the back of my mind. I even wonder about things like that to this day. What, like, if that didn't happen, or if this other situation didn't happen, would I be on the path that I would? And the answer is easy. Of course not. Everything in our past kind of sets us on the path that we have moving forward. Some of it more than others, some of it less than others, but it very clearly impacted me, if I remember it, what, 40 years later?
I want to add one thing, though, because you said you brought up the example of like, you know, football player or baseball player. The sad thing about our sport is that there's a guy who could not have trained until he was 25, pick up some weights, and by the time he's 30, he's on the Olympia stage.
Yes.
Like, whereas like the professional sports like football, basketball, whatever, like you saw them develop in the farm, you know, in the high school leagues and then college and whatnot. So you know that they're going to be who they are. But like, say for instance, like Andrew Jacked, you know,
yeah.
Did anyone know who he was 2.5 years ago?
No.
Now he's a top five Olympian. He just came out of the blue, started lifting some weights, and now he's one of the top guys in the world. That's that's the thing in our sport.
That is different.
It's different. It's you have to have a very trying to think of the wording. You just have to be very realistic with yourself and understand that it's not your results are not necessarily a reflection of your efforts compared to other people, right?
Yeah,
because you might work twice as hard as that guy. It's just he's got better genetics than you.
Yeah. The cool thing with what we do, though, versus baseball and basketball and football is you're going to be, like you said, you're gonna know early on whether you're going to really excel at those sports, which is the point that you're making. But here's the cool thing about bodybuilding is even if you're mediocre at it, and I'm right there, I put myself, so I'm speaking about myself, even if you're mediocre at it, you can continue to do it even for a long time and still continue to get better. Maybe not Nick Walker better, you know, between shows and everything else, but you can still continue to progress. And, you know, it provides, you know, an outlet it provides, if you want to call it, you know, I don't want to say it's not self-worth, it's self-esteem. It's things that it's something that I carry that fortunately I've been passionate about. And I've enjoyed doing. Otherwise, I wouldn't be training for 40 years.
I'm right there with you, man.
But at the same time, and I think that it's a cool thing that you can carry that in later into life versus there's no way I can swing a bat without throwing my, you know, even guys who are good, you're not going to be swinging a bat very hard after, you know, your late 30s or into your 40s. It's just not going to happen. Or pitching or that sort of thing. You're just not going to be able to do that. Even at the elite level, they're done by 40, but you can continue, you know, the Brady's and the Elways and that sort of thing. But you can continue to do this as long as you're physically able. And if you know what you're doing, if you're relatively smart, you know, you stay consistent with it, you can continue to do it until the day before they put you in the ground.
And you can keep doing it competitively for a long time too. It's not just, you know, it kind of irritates me when I hear guys figure out that they're never, or they decide they're like, maybe they haven't even tried and they're like, oh, I'm never going to be a Nick Walker. So why even compete? I'm never going to turn pro. It's like, it's not about that. It's about doing the best you can, you know,
is to a lot of people. It really is about that to a lot of people. That's the thing.
But it's none a shame, of us, man.
None of us would ever said, well, you know, I'm not going to be a Brady, so I really don't want to do it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to be as good as Terrell Davis, so I don't want to do it. That's just an odd
here's a question then. Here's a question for the future that we're not going to know the answer to today, but because I feel like what we're talking about, our generation definitely feels that way. But a lot of these newer Instagram guys, people that are in there with the tripods, like, are they going to still be doing that 20, 25 years later like we are?
And that's what I always question. Our generation, I know I don't like to make this about the kids or anything, but our generation is, I think it was incredibly and still is incredibly passionate about the lifestyle and about just being a bodybuilder. And that's why I don't like when people say, oh, you don't compete, you're not a bodybuilder. You can't tell someone that they don't compete that they're not a bodybuilder. That's just silly. That's your lame definition of what a bodybuilder should be. If you live the lifestyle and you consider yourself a bodybuilder, you're a bodybuilder. Even if you suck, you're a bodybuilder.
Yeah.
I got no problem with that. I'm not going to battle you on that. Cripe. I hope nobody would battle me on that. They're going to judge me and tell me I'm not a bodybuilder. I haven't competed in 12 years. You're not a bodybuilder. What? I'm not a competitive bodybuilder. Yeah. I may still be, but I'm not now. Okay.
You know what I think though, Andrew, is that maybe it's more popular now than we were when we were younger. So maybe some of the, like a lot of the guys who found it, maybe found it for the right reasons, or maybe they got into it and then they discovered the right reasons. And so maybe more people stuck with it. Young, you know, the older generation, the younger generation, you know, I bet that some of the guys along the way are going to discover some of the rewards that we are talking about, and that they'll still be the ones to stick with it. The guys that really figure it out, they're still going to be banging it out in 20 years, you know?
I just hear, because I've had these conversations with people, and I just kind of like nod and go, huh, yeah. Some of these guys in the gym where, you know, they're like, well, you know, I look like this and I only got third place at nationals. Like what? They want me to put like on another 10 pounds. Like, what am I going to kill myself for that?
Yes. I like, hear that too.
Nah, like I'm done, you know, like it's not worth it. In my mind, it's like, well, then bodybuilding isn't worth it to you. Like the lifelong aspect of bodybuilding, you're really just chasing the quote unquote plastic trophy in that sense.
Yeah. I'm with you. Well, now that we sound like a bunch of old guys, I think that's a good place to wrap the show up. Eat your vegetables, stay in school. All that.
Don't do drugs.
You know, I was going to go there, but
we got a lot of them.
We just got demonetized. We're back on the radar now.
You're never going to keep up with Nick Walker if you don't. Let's say that. We appreciate you guys tuning in, and thank you for hanging out with us. Like I said before, leave us questions for the next episode because we are going to need them. Also, you know, comment with guest ideas. We'd love to bring out some more guests, so tell us who you'd like to see on the show. And of course, check out TrueNutrition.com. Use our code THINK over there. Let me know if you have any questions about any of their products, anything like the Team Skip blend or anything else they carry. Highly Brain Cyclic Dextrin. I'm really pushing for their Highly Brain Cyclic Dextrin now because there are few companies out there that are offering a true, actual Highly Brain Cyclic Dextrin that's not cut with dextrose or some patented BS blend. You pay for what you're getting. So check them out, True Nutrition, use their Highly Brain Cyclic Dextrin, use code THINK. And of course, go over to supplementsource.ca for Canadians because they have a lot of deals that change week to week, label changes, short-dated products, supplements, as I mentioned, supplementsource.ca. And Patreon, thank you guys, everybody, for Patreon. And bodyberry.com, teamskip.com, mcnallydiets@gmail.com. Guys, for another episode of Blood, Sweat, and Gear, we'll see you soon. Thanks, everybody.